We've got our last panel discussion for the day. I'm going to invite those guys up here. And we're going to be talking about the energy water nexus.
Presentation on a proposed bioenergy park in San Francisco, where they will be incorporating a water utility as well as solid waste in developing biofuels from the water processes is something that we'll talk about in this water energy nexus. But that whole park is, at least the artist's conception, was going to be housed in a facility covered by a green roof, and not just a green roof, but a green roof that if you squinted, looked a little bit like Texas Stadium's roof. So I think there could be two projects there for our consultants. You can either talk to us when we're doing a bioenergy park here in Austin, or go up to Dallas and work on getting Texas Stadium to take on a green roof project. Good luck with that. Thank you, Laura. I started with the water utility about 2 years ago, specifically to help them take on inventorying their greenhouse gas emissions in anticipation of the city's climate protection program. And immediately on taking on that inventory, it was clear that over 90% of the water utilities greenhouse gas emissions are related to energy, 88% from electric use, 4% from fleet. So climate very quickly morphed into understanding energy and how energy is critical to providing water. So Energy Water Nexus is central to my work, and I'm happy to introduce Amy to expand on exactly what we mean when we talk about the Energy Water Nexus. Amy is, you can read along with me, is an attorney with Environmental Defense Fund. She splits her time with the fund between the Climate and Air Program, where she successfully coordinated the effort against the recently proposed TXU coal plants, as well as with the Land, Water, and Wildlife Program, where she works on various Texas water issues, including conservation and this energy water nexus. Amy is a member of the State Bar of Texas, and the Western District of Texas is a registered professional geoscientist in the state of Texas. She holds a BS in geology from Earlham College, and I'll interject here as well. Amy is the third Earlham College graduate that I have met through professional circles here locally. So let me take this moment. If you are an Earlham College graduate, Okay. We may have exhausted the Earlham College connection here, but kudos to Earlham. She also has a MS in geology from UT San Antonio and a JD from Texas Tech School of Law. So I'm happy to introduce Amy.
For those of you that don't know why it's so amazing that there are three Earlham people in David's life, let me just tell you, it has 1,200 students total. So, it's in Indiana, rural Indiana. So to bump into an Earlham geologist here in Texas is sort of like, I don't know, seeing the salamander in the few of the springs around here. As was explained, I sort of have a water background that found myself similar. David, sort of tripping myself into the air world when I joined EDF about 3 years ago, which ended up being fortuitous, actually, because it sort of led to all of this work and sort of put us on the cutting edge of something totally and utterly by accident. So don't let anybody tell you that we really have that much forethought. But so one of those is sort of the energy water nexus. That's how we've coined it, and that's how I've heard it also called water G. That sounds like some sort of dysentery to me, so we stay away from that. And the basic sort of idea is that throughout time and the sort of evolution of our industrial society, we've developed infrastructures. We've developed water infrastructure, we've developed an air infrastructure, and we've done them pretty much in two separate streams. One side hasn't really had to talk to the other. We see this evidenced in a lot of ways. There's even very few cities, I mean, Austin is one, and San Antonio, Patrick sort of is part of this, that are lucky enough to have city utilities in both the power sector and the water sector. But generally, these are provided for consumers in two totally separate streams. They come in two separate bills. They're metered separately, which is becoming, now that we have more of a crunch on the need for both power and water, suddenly, this separation doesn't seem like such a good idea. And I'll sort of talk about why that is and how much of a relationship there really is between these two sectors and why they should sort of start coming together. And this has really new and exciting meaning under the future of a carbon-constrained world. So this is going to be a true 30,000 feet would be an understatement. This might be, you know, the astronaut's view of this, but we have some great experts that will go into more detail and, of course, correct me on all the things that I say wrong. Wait, how do I make it go? Is it the middle button? Ooh. Oh, that one. Of course, that's counterintuitive to me. Okay. So start with the picture. It's not nearly as exciting or pretty as the roof one, so you totally outdid me on pictures there. But this is sort of a quick snapshot of all the ways that energy and water are related. The blue arrows being water and the red arrows being energy. And as you can see, you have things coming and going from the housing district to the wastewater and water treatment to the power plant to dams. And what's not even part of this picture or part of this presentation, but please keep it in the back of your mind, is all the water that we're using in the transportation fuel sector, which is sort of a whole other discussion as we get into biofuels. But we're not going to touch on that today, or we'd be here far longer than you want to be. So, you know, lots of words up there. The big picture is that we use a lot of water to generate energy. We use a lot of energy to get the water nice and clean into your house and take it away from you and put it somewhere else. And the issue is that the relationship is already under strain. Population, environmental constraints, infrastructure are all sort of reaching sort of a fevered pitch, and we have to start sort of looking at these things together. Weather patterns, climate change is just adding to this, and that the trends of intensity in both sectors are actually growing. So what you end up having is this sort of exponential pressure getting put on these and sort of this need to move quickly. And then added on that is what's going to happen with federal and state legislation constraining carbon emissions coming into the future, and Ron will tell us a lot more about that. Just to give you an idea, this is withdrawals, not consumption. So I think most people in this room probably are pretty clear on the difference, when you pull it out, when you don't put it back in. So this is just withdrawals. But as you can see, the thermoelectric industry is the blue. It's darn big. You know, we talk about ag being a big user, and certainly it is. But when you're looking at bang for your buck, you cannot ignore the energy sector for withdrawals. And, you know, a lot of things, I'll talk about this slightly later, a lot of information or industry or regulatory components really focus on the consumptive part, but the withdrawal part is equally important. If you pull that water out, it is not available for use for people, for plants, and for critters. That's the end of it. Now, maybe it gets put back in, but there's certainly a gap where that water is not available. Okay, clearly, we don't need to talk about all these numbers, but I just wanted to give you a snapshot and sort of go into the water use for energy production. So obviously you have it on the mining side, you have it on the transportation side, but the real big hit and the hit that we've really been looking at is in the actual power generation part. And the majority of that water gets used in the cooling technology, and it's also variable based on the type of fuel that you're using in that power plant. So as you can see, as you move from open loop cooling towards hot air cooling, you have a huge span of amounts of water both withdrawn and consumed. This is actually the consumptive table here. So that's the water that you're just not going to see again, at least in that regional area. So, you know, these numbers can be pretty high, especially in the coal sector and also the nuclear sector. If you saw the withdrawal numbers, nuclear would make your jaw drop a little bit. So we started looking at, well, what does this mean for Texas? And EDF partnered with University of Texas, and Carrie is one of the co-authors on this. And we started thinking, you know, in order to really look at this and figure out what we need to do, we first need to figure out what it really means for us. So we wanted to quantify this relationship in Texas going both directions, energy for water and water for energy. And that had really never been done before. There has been an energy for water study done in California, but other than that, not a lot of states have really taken stock on what this relationship is. And we had a little trouble doing it, too, and I'll get into that. But and I should have put the website, and you guys can ask me about this, but it's and Laura might have to help me, www.edf.org/Texas Energy Water Nexus, all one word. So the full report and some video blogs, which just don't watch it, it's awful. They made me do it, or on that. So looking, this is what happens, this new Web 2.0 thing, it's a total disaster. We're tweeting and video blogs. I don't know. I think I'm more old school than I realize. Anyway, so on the water for energy side, this is just generally going to be easier to quantify because of the regulatory constraints and reporting requirements that already exist in the power sector, both on a federal and a state level. But even that being said, there's a lot of question marks because are they really looking at what matters to you and I in terms of water availability? And the answer is not really. So these are the things that mattered. Fuel type, and think back on that big graph that I put up. Fuel type, type of cooling technology, and that's what we focused on. We did not quantify the amount of water involved in the mining process or in the transportation process, but that's not to be ignored. If you really wanted to see a full picture and that sort of embedded water cost, you would have to look at those things. This is a quick picture of where our power plants are. No surprise that most of them are on the east side of the state where the water and the people are. What we're seeing now, or what's predicted, is a shift to more power plants in West Texas because that's where the CREZ lines are going to be installed, as well as you have less sort of air constraints. There's not as many non-attainment areas. However, water is sparse, so it opens sort of a new can of worms. So now might be the time to be talking about this. So just some statistics on the bottom that bear sort of noting. The power capacity for all the dots is 110 gigawatts, and actual generation is 400 terawatt hours. And all the results that we found were actually based on the current power production, not on the maximization. So if we took ERCOT, basically builds in a cushion automatically, plus there's a cushion we aren't always using the maximum amount that we can produce. So you can imagine that this number, and this is a number we're going to run for some later reports, what happens, even if we don't build a single other power plant, what happens if you're running every single plant at max capacity at the same time? How much water does that use? Because this number will actually be lower than what that number would be. So just sort of a food for thought. So what does it mean? Well, with the actual power that we're producing in Texas, we're using, consuming, not withdrawing, using 157,000 million gallons. So that's basically the equivalent of 3 million people a year using 140 GPCD. So, you know, not a Dallas, in fact, not even an Austin, but a few more in San Antonio, this would be more than 3 million people. So it's a lot of water. And power plants are responsible for about 2.5% of the water consumption in the entire state. The gaps that we found in actually being able to really well quantify this are that it's really the consumption that ends up getting reported and not the withdrawals. So the way Texas law reads, if you have a reservoir associated with your power plant and you're able to run that power plant with your reservoir, you have enough in your reservoir, you would report your water consumption use as zero because you're actually sort of, you know, using, you're not having to take any from additional state water to run your plant. Well, in the real world, that's not really zero. We all know that. I mean, first of all, that you're not putting all that water back in the reservoir, and second of all, it doesn't account for things like evaporation that's naturally happening in that reservoir. So it's somewhat of a misnomer. So really what we'd like to see is a policy move towards real quantification. And things like withdrawal do end up mattering because it's not available for other users. So the flip side, this even becomes even more difficult to quantify because a lot of this stuff just flat out isn't measured. So what we did was we looked at the things that we could easily sort of estimate, which was the power for water treatment and the power for wastewater treatment. What didn't get included are some of the biggest users, including in-use users, which is, you know, all of us in our homes when we take a hot shower, run our dishwasher or our washing machine. There really isn't, because the metering is separate, it's going to vary a lot from household to household. And in general, most of these numbers will vary considerably based on region. For example, water supply. If you're piping the water uphill, it's going to be different than if you're piping it downhill. If it's 100, you know, if your water source is 100 miles away, that's going to make a difference. So this becomes very difficult to quantify accurately. It can be done, but we'd have to change our infrastructure measurements to do that. So similarly, you're going to see sort of the same scatter pattern that you saw with the power plants, because again, the people are there, the industry's there. And what we did find is that this is just the water treatment and wastewater treatment. It's 2.1 to 2.7 terawatts of electricity for water systems, and 1.1 to 2.2 for wastewater systems. So together, they're 0.8 to 1.3 of the Texas electricity, and 2.2 to 3.4. This is actually a little bit lower than the United States average. And we think that the reason for that is that Texas is such a huge power user in general that it actually sort of throws the percentage statistics off. So if you look at the percentage as a qualitative comparison, Texas looks lower. If you look at the actual amount of power used next to the actual amount of power used for another state, you'll see that we're actually quite high, and it would have an impact. And again, those are the data gaps that we weren't able to quantify that you'd want to include. So what does this mean? What does this mean in terms of sort of our world? Why am I up here? Well, it matters. It matters because for power and water security, among other things. In France and also in the southeastern United States, when they had their recent drought, you saw power plants either having to shut down or threaten to shut down because the water either wasn't there or was there at such a high temperature that the power plant, in this case nuclear plants, weren't able to function as prescribed. So this can be make a big difference, not to mention that it's pulling all this water out that other users need. So, you know, that's just some quotes. Anyway, so then on top of all this, not to just freak everybody out, but you have, you know, population growth, you've got fuel mix changing, you have air quality considerations. All these plants have emissions. What does that mean in terms of water, changing technology, and climate change? So how does this impact this already slightly dysfunctional system? Well, the issue is that the relationship gets more complicated because a power plant releases carbon emissions. It's using water. The power plant is potentially adding to climate change. That might make the climate more variable. You might get less water in an area, which is then going to affect the power plant all over again. So you have this sort of feedback loop happening, which could be exacerbating this issue. So I think everybody's probably pretty familiar with this, that it's fairly widely agreed that we have this sort of greenhouse gas issue, carbon being one of the largest components of that. And why do we care here? Well, the U.S. puts a lot of it out, and Texas puts a lot of it out. If we were a country, we would be the seventh highest emitter in the world. So it matters here. It matters a lot. We also have lots of non-attainment cities and more moving in that direction, including the one that you are in right now. So not just EDF, but governments in general have sort of started to think, or the United States government's coming around and thinking, you know, what are we going to do about this? We've got carbon emissions off the charts. Climate's getting impacted. What are we going to do? Well, one of the things that seems to be going forward is this idea of cap and trade. So I want to just take a minute and talk about cap and trade because it's an important part of what we talk about when we say carbon markets. Just like anything else, if nobody wants to buy what you're selling, it's not going to have a price. And I think that ties in well with some of the water discussions and the reverse auction. There needs to be a value placed on your product. And one of the ways that you can place a value on carbon is to create a cap and trade type marketplace. And just a quick description of what that is, I'm sure you've all read about it. Most of you probably understand it, but it took me a long time before I sort of got it, and Ron will probably tell me I did it wrong, but I'll give it a whirl. So here's a power plant, right? And that's its smokestack, and what's coming out of it is its carbon emissions. And the government comes in and says, you know what? You need to take your emissions, and you need to divide them in half. Your power plant was doing that much. It needs to get down to that much. Well, what's a power plant to do? And it doesn't just have to be a power plant, by the way. It could be industry, so I'm just using power plants as a scapegoat, but they're not the only emitters. I know that. So they have a choice. They can change their business practice figure out a new technology, retrofit it, any of these things, and they can reduce the actual amount coming out. That's not always going to be possible. They may not be able, it might be cost prohibitive to do that. There could be a million technology reasons they can't do that, or they just might decide not to. So there has to be an alternative for them. And the alternative for that is offsets. So what an offset is a program that takes carbon out of the air and basically buys you the opportunity to put it in the air so that you have eventually a reduction, because the amount of offsets are going to be reduced over time, available are going to be reduced over time. So they can either reduce to the gray, or they can then go buy the greens and pinks and blues. So the way I like to think about a cap and trade system is like musical chairs. I think we all remember musical chairs. There's even a funny commercial that does musical chairs right now. And an offset is a chair. And every time you go around the circle, one chair gets taken away. So the way that we reduce the amount of carbon in the air over time is to take away the chairs. And so when you do that, the chairs become more valuable. You want that chair more so you can stay in the game and keep walking around the circle. And that's where the market comes in. You've created a market for your chair. And so there you have all the sort of the extras. The flip side is, if they reduce on their own to that half, they get that extra that they can then sell or do whatever they want with. So you end up sort of, it's just like any other market, except what you're trading are these offsets. And here's just sort of a different picture on how that works. So why does that matter to us? Why are we talking about it at a water conference? Well, so here's my big drum roll, bringing it all together. So just a quick review. We know what an offset is. Who would pay for it? Anybody that needs to reduce their carbon emissions that can't do it through other ways would be potential purchasers of an offset. How much would they pay? Well, it depends. How much is it worth at the time? We would expect that number to increase as the offset allocations were reduced and the chairs became more and more valuable. Europe has a trading system. I'm sure that Ron can talk a little bit about that. So the numbers fluctuated. There is a carbon market right now, and I'm sure you've seen it, where you can offset your plane flights or your car. There's Trip Verde, I think, is one of them. But because there's no true market constraint on the carbon, that value is a little bit, I don't want to say untrustworthy, but it's certainly not synonymous with what we would see under a true carbon economy, carbon market. So that number would change. And why does water matter in this discussion? Well, the truth is we don't know, but we have a few really cool ideas. We talked earlier about water being an offset sort of for itself. So if you have a water-neutral subdivision, you could kind of have an offset market for water in and of itself. This is slightly different. This is using water as a carbon offset. Looking back at the previous slides of the relationship between energy and water and how much energy is expended moving and treating water, the next step would be, if you conserve water, you're in actuality saving emissions. Now, how you quantify that, how you put a number to it, who gets that offset, is sort of a whole other can of worms that we're sort of in the middle of digging through, and I think will lead to a good discussion, I hope. I'm just going to touch on this briefly because I want Ron to sort of go into it in the discussion. There's a lot of discussion about, quote, good offsets. Obviously, you want an offset to matter. If someone's getting the credit for an offset, you want to know that they really took carbon out of the atmosphere, not just kinda, or, you know, so it's not the sort of greenwashing idea. And there's several things that words that we throw around in this discussion. One is that it has to be measurable. This becomes a challenge in the water world. How do you measure, going back to all the things that we couldn't measure for our report, how do you then measure how much was saved? Additionality. It has to be. You have to show that would have not that it would have happened anyways. It has to be extra. And leakage is sort of confusing, but it's basically that it sort of ties to the additionality. You have to make sure that you're not sort of saving water in one place, but then using it, you know, somewhere else, so you don't have a net gain. And permanence. You have to take it out of the air permanently. Am I done? Oh, I am done. So that's sort of the 60,000 feet. Now, we hope your questions will bring us down all the way down to the ground. And I look forward to hearing the discussion.